we have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard facts.
We will apply unprecedented financial pressure on the Iranian regime. The leaders in Tehran will have no doubt about our seriousness. These will indeed end up being the strongest sanctions in history when we are complete.
President Donald Trump has issued an executive order imposing new economic sanctions on Venezuela. The order bans U.S. citizens or anyone living in the U.S. from being involved in the purchase of any debt owed to the government of Venezuela. Earlier in a tweet, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said fraudulent elections do not change anything.
Through my anti-war activism, I realized that you need media for the people, right? Because it doesn't matter what your issue is. You could be passionate about GMOs, you could be passionate about the water supply, about war. As long as you don't have a free media, it doesn't matter.
Thank you very much, everybody. It's a great honor to have the Crown Prince with us. Saudi Arabia has been a very great friend and a big purchaser of equipment and lots of other things. And one of the biggest investments in the United States is your big investment is buying stock in companies and various other things in the United States and creating jobs.
What does it say when Iran, a country with no nuclear weapons, whose compliance with the terms of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, otherwise known as the P5+1 Iran nuclear deal, has been absolute yet finds itself threatened with war by Washington, while Israel, with hundreds of nuclear weapons, illegally acquired and completely undeclared, remains Washington's closest ally? What does it say when Washington announces fresh sanctions against Venezuela for the crime of electing a government it does not approve of, while Saudi Arabia, a state in which the mere mention of the word election is likely to get you flogged, is deemed an invaluable ally and friend? What does it say when a US President Donald Trump is willing to humiliate Washington's long-standing European allies, France, Germany and the UK, over the previously mentioned Iran nuclear deal, yet Russia, cooperating with Europe on the Iran deal, is considered a threat to peace and stability by said US-European allies? What does it say when Tony Blair, despite helping to unleash an illegal war on Iraq, can remain a member in good standing of the Labour Party, while Ken Livingstone, for the transgression of crudely articulating the brief and verifiable history of German Zionist cooperation with the Nazis, is hounded out of the Labour Party? What does it say when journalists with proud records of opposing disastrous and catastrophic regime change wars are victimised, depicted as marginal outriders existing outwith the bounds of acceptable political discourse, while staunch advocates of regime change wars are leading columnists at the London Times, Telegraph, Guardian and other mainstream newspapers in the UK? What does it say when the owner and founder of Wikipedia dismisses out of hand evidence of the malicious tampering and editing of the pages of those anti-war dissident voices, while ensuring that the pages of those prominent pro-war and pro-regime change advocates are edited to remove information that shows them in a negative light? What it says is that the neoliberal, neoconservative status quo has entered its mad dog days, thrashing around in a desperate attempt to arrest political decline, mounting a withering attack on dissenting voices at home and dissenting governments abroad, upending, in the process, any last vestige of credibility and claim to propriety. A crisis of unprecedented dimension is the result, stretching the sinews of stability to breaking point, evidence that the status quo has never appeared more insecure, with its loyal servants deploying ever more outlandish defences as its dire consequences become increasingly acute. No royal wedding and no deluge of mainstream media guff, peddled by establishment foot soldiers masquerading as journalists, can deflect from the fact we have come to a fork in the road. Either we continue on the road to perdition, political, cultural, economic, or we change direction and head instead for destination hope in the shape of a world absent of hegemony, hypocrisy, and exceptionalism. Dissent, rather than a badge of shame, is a badge of honour, separating those who refuse to make their peace with injustice and oppression from those who go along to get along. Our lives begin to end the day we become silent about things that matter, said Martin Luther King. And silence, as we navigate the rapids of this neocon upside-down world, is not an option. I'm John White, and this is Hard Facts. Of those dissenting anti-war voices that have come in for attack in the mainstream, none is more prominent than writer and broadcaster Neil Clark, who joins me now. Neil, welcome to the show.
Good evening, John. Hello there.
Now, I drew the connection between the increasingly desperate and withering attacks on dissident governments abroad and dissenting voices at home. Do you agree with that connection?
Absolutely. And we've got to link everything up here. It seems to me that we're in what I think you call yourself the mad dog days of the neocon imperialist project, aren't we? Really, things have gone badly wrong for them. Clearly in Syria, the Assad government was meant to have gone by now. Syria, the idea, of course, was to break up the Syrian-Iranian Hezbollah axis, and it hasn't worked. And so therefore, we see a new stage in this project, which is even more hysterical, more rabid than the one that went before. We're seeing this Russophobia hyped up, this ludicrous claims blaming Russia for just about everything that goes on in the world, for blaming them for Brexit, blaming them for the heavy snow we had in March, etc. And so the lies are getting more outrageous. And so at the same time, John, are the attacks on dissidents becoming more severe, more McCarthyite. And we're entering into this period, I think, of extreme witch hunting now. And we see that, of course, almost on a daily basis now, with Ken Livingston, the latest victim of this. So I think, and also speaking as a journalist, I think that the way that dissent is clamped down on now is far worse than it was, in fact, 10, 12 years ago in the aftermath of the Iraq War or in the build-up to the Iraq War. Things have actually got worse since then. The space is not open to us anymore. The spaces that were open to us then are not open to us anymore. Just think about the way The Guardian has changed, The New Statesman has changed, all these places where what I wrote regularly for, John Pilger wrote regularly for, they're not. They're now, basically following the neocon line. So I think it is very, very disturbing what has happened.
I mean, in a broader sense, and I failed to mention these individuals, and I should have in my intro, perhaps, Edward Snowden, he is forced to seek sanctuary in Russia. Russia, which is depicted as a fount of oppression and repression. Yet here we have a dissident journalist in the US, the land of the free, whose crime was to reveal the mass surveillance program, illegal under the US Constitution and Bill of Rights, to the public. Then there's Julian Assange, still holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he's been for the last 5 years in a state of de facto solitary confinement, again for the crime of revealing the war crimes of the US in Iraq, and also the machinations of governments and the elites throughout the West. It is self-evident, I think, that we have entered a sinister period because they're losing. They're panicking. They fail to have the same authority at home. There's more and more scepticism abroad among the general public when it comes to, for example, their narrative on the Skripal poisoning, on what's going on in Syria. We saw this evidence with the Duma alleged chemical weapons attack. And so they're turning their guns on people like yourself who dare raise their voice against this narrative, this regime change, warmongering narrative. Where do you think we stand when it comes to the Labour Party in particular, Neil? Because when Jeremy Corbyn was elected, there was a massive, massive outpouring of optimism and enthusiasm. People were becoming engaged in politics again who dropped out, and younger people were coming into politics for the first time. I will never forget the scene of Jeremy Corbyn, the most unlikely Labour leader ever, considering the decades he spent on the back benches, ploughing a relatively lonely furrow as a dissident voice himself. But it seems to me that he's increasingly being neutered as that dissident voice. Am I being too harsh?
I don't think you are, John. I think our friend George Galloway has written a very good piece in which he says that Jeremy Corbyn unfortunately has shown more loyalty so far to his enemies than to his comrades and to his friends. And I think that's been the case. I think that what seems to have happened is that Jeremy seems to be under the impression that he has to kind of throw overboard, if you like, a number of people who he was closely associated with in order to get establishment approval, in order to be allowed to win, if you like, that he's got to people like Ken Livingston, particularly Mark Wadsworth's gone, and also to shift on foreign policy. He was, we all remember, very, very critical of NATO, for example, before he became the leader. And then during the election campaign, he said that he actually supported NATO. And now you could argue that Jeremy hasn't had the support in the PLP. He's very much, he was, as we know, that was the members who voted him in, the Parliamentary Labour Party. Only a relatively small percentage of them could be said to be backing Jeremy Corbyn. So therefore, he's got to, you could argue, compromise because of that. But what's actually happened? There's been no moves. We've had a lot of talk, but where are the what actually is going to happen about deselections?
For our international listeners, explain what you mean by deselections.
Well, the problem with Labour, as I see it, is that there is the membership, which generally speaking has had enough of Blairism, had enough of neoliberalism, and certainly had enough of neoconservative wars. And then you've got the PLP, which hasn't. The PLP, the Parliamentary Labour Party, the Labour MPs, they are predominantly either hardcore Blairites or soft Blairites. And this is the basic problem that we've got in Labour, and that unless these MPs are deselected at local level, in other words, the local party would have the right, would be able to choose other people to represent them who are more in line with their views, this problem isn't going to go away. And I tell you what I really do fear, John. I fear that the scenario which could happen is that Jeremy Corbyn continues on this path of appeasing his enemies by keep throwing old allies over to them to try to appease them. And then what would happen is that after the election, let's suppose Labour does have a victory, does have a victory of 20 or 30 seats with the same PLP, I'm afraid they're not going to back him. People like John Woodcock has already said, the right-wing Labour MP has already said he wouldn't support a Corbyn government. So we could have a lot of enthusiasm about Labour coming into power, back into power under Jeremy Corbyn, and it could all end in tears because deselections haven't taken place. I can't stress enough how important deselections are to get a parliamentary party that's more representative of the members.
When you say deselections, technically, what do you mean deselections? Deselecting MPs from their seats who are recalcitrant, who refuse to support Jeremy Corbyn despite his mandate?
I believe Tony Benn had it right all those years ago. I think he said every couple of years the MPs should have to go back to their constituencies and go up for re-election among the party, because basically there's a lot of MPs there, I won't name them all, who are basically hard right. They're pro-war, they want to bomb Syria, they are hawks, they are neoliberals, they've supported privatisation. These people's views, John, are inimical to the majority of Labour Party members, and they will be a block. They basically exist as a block to any real change in this country. So they're the establishment's people inside Labour. So that if we do get a Labour government, they will block any real change. Any change will...
Well, they are the very epitome of the term Her Majesty's loyal opposition. What we need is Her Majesty's disloyal opposition. You're listening to Neil Clark. This is Hard Facts. We'll be right back.
We have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard Facts.
Welcome back to the second half of Hard Facts. I'm sitting down with writer and broadcaster and prominent dissident voice in the UK when it comes to foreign policy and the economy, Neil Clark. Now, Neil, Ken Livingston, a 50-year veteran of the Labour Party, 40 of those years spent in prominent positions as head of the Greater London Council in the 1980s. He led one of the few bastions of resistance to Thatcherism, responsible for propelling the cause of ethnic and minority rights, of gay rights, into the mainstream. He stands on the side of the oppressed and always has done on the side of the Palestinians against apartheid in South Africa, anti-war. As Mayor of London, he served two terms between 2000 and 2008. First term as an independent, second terms as a Labour mayor, the most progressive mayor that London has ever had. A stalwart of the left, and yet he did make a mistake. He crudely articulated, as I briefly mentioned, the history of verifiable German Zionist collaboration with the Nazis in the early 1930s, under the auspices of the Havara Agreement. It was an agreement that was roundly criticised in the wider Zionist movement, and indeed it was responsible for breaking the international anti-Nazi boycott, which was instituted by the Jewish community in New York. And Chaim Arzdorov, an architect of the Havara Agreement, was later assassinated in, I believe it was Haifa, by the revisionist faction of the Zionist movement. So clearly, this is a complex history, not one given to shorthand articulation, as Ken attempted to. But the fact that he, for crudely articulating this history, has been hounded out of the Labour Party, hung out to dry in the mainstream, yet Tony Blair, as I speak, was on the BBC Radio 4 flagship morning programme, the Today programme, being treated as an elder statesman, asked for his views on Brexit, asked for his views on Europe, asked for his views on Ireland, and so on and so on. That really sums up where we are, doesn't it?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, a Labour Party that doesn't have a place in it for Ken Livingstone, who, as you said, has been an incredible campaigner over 50 years for socialist causes, as you said, a trailblazer for many important issues that at the time weren't really prominent. He took a lot of flak, for example, by supporting gay rights at the time when basically a lot of people weren't supporting that. When you think the Labour Party hasn't got room for him today, neither has it got room for George Galloway, again, a man who for 50-odd years has been at the forefront, really, of every progressive campaign in Britain, fighting against war, fighting against injustice. When they haven't got room for those two figures, and yet they've still got room for Tony Blair, who, you know, launched an illegal war with George Bush against Iraq, which led to a million people dying and how many more millions being displaced, setting the Middle East on fire, then really that's a very sad and sorry state of affairs. And what makes it even worse, I think, is that Jeremy Corbyn is the leader now. And it would have seemed incredible, I think, and you probably agree with this, when Jeremy was elected leader, that, what was it now, it's nearly 3 years down the line, we've got a Labour Party without Ken and without George Galloway. That would have been, it seemed to be far-fetched at that point, wouldn't it? Because we were hoping that Jeremy would bring George Galloway back in. And certainly we did not think that Ken Livingstone would basically be forced out of the Labour Party for allegations of racism. It's absolutely beyond belief, isn't it, really, the way things have gone. And I think that it needs to be rectified. I think that Jeremy Corbyn now, I'm afraid, look at that tweet from Lord Sugar, who's been a real opponent of Jeremy Corbyn. He said, good riddance to Ken. Now let's get Jeremy Corbyn out. So I think Jeremy Corbyn, if he believes that throwing Ken overboard or not doing enough to defend Ken, put it that way, is the way to peace and the way that he will get people off his back, totally wrong. I saw a tweet from Wes Streeting, one of the most anti-Corbyn Labour MPs. He said, right, Ken's gone now. Now his supporters must go. His cheerleaders must go as well. The witch hunters have been emboldened by this, and they're now looking for new witches.
But Neil, even on the left, I mean, I've made this point before, and I think you agree, there is a distinction to be made between the domesticated left and the non-domesticated left. And prominent within the domesticated left is Owen Jones, author, broadcaster and journalist in the UK. And he sent out a tweet in response to Ken Livingstone's resignation. I'm paraphrasing now. This is a welcome turn of events. Ken Livingstone could have gone down as one of the most progressive mayor London ever had, but he's trashed his reputation. Labour now has to continue to work to repair its relationship with the British Jewish community. Now, I would suggest that everything in that tweet is redolent of the bubble that these people exist in, because the Labour Party's task, I would contend, is to repair its relationship with the working class, which includes Jewish people.
Of course, yeah.
And we know for a fact that the British Jewish community is not one homogenous block, as Owen Jones and his co-thinkers like to maintain. It is a community of different class, different political views, and many of those are on our side of the argument when it comes to dissenting against the mainstream.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's absolutely totally patronising people like Owen Jones to claim to know what the Jewish, so-called Jewish community think in one block, as if it's one block. There'll be, I'm sure, an awful lot of Jewish people in Britain will be very sad to see what's happened to Ken Livingstone, who remember the great work he did on housing, on transport, on gay rights, against racism. What we've got is an uber Blairite lobby that is very, very, I think George Galloway said it's coterminous with, you know, with the Labour Friends of Israel. Virtually all the members are members of Labour Friends of Israel. And they obviously were gunning for Ken. And the idea that these people, many of them are not Jewish, large number of them, or large percentage or majority are not Jewish. The idea that they are the people who'd say what the Jewish community is thinking and what the Jewish community's voice view is absolutely obscene. And I think I can give a couple of examples of just how ridiculous the whole thing is. You've got Joan Ryan, who is the head of Labour Friends of Israel. She was actually writing to Corbyn, urging Jeremy Corbyn not to associate with Max Blumenthal. Now, who's Max Blumenthal? He's a very good anti-war writer. He's been on your show, hasn't he, John, a couple of times,
I think. And he happens to be Jewish.
Yeah. And she's urging Joan Ryan, who I don't believe is Jewish, from Labour Friends of Israel, is urging Corbyn to disassociate with a Jewish writer on the grounds of alleged anti-Semitism. Max is a strong critic of Israel. He's Jewish. So it shows you what a farce this whole thing is.
Navigating the rapids of a neocon upside down world. Isn't that right? Isn't that absolutely right?
Totally. And so we're getting a lot of very good Jewish activists being targeted here and being called anti-Semites by people who aren't Jewish. That's how ludicrous. Of course, another example, John, is what happened over Easter when the Pesach, when Jeremy Corbyn marked Passover with a Jewish group, Judas. Now, you would have thought that was a very good gesture. He's reaching out to the Jewish community. Not at all. He was condemned again by people like John Woodcock, who is not Jewish, for spending Passover with a Jewish group. Why? They were the wrong Jewish group. They were not a strongly pro-Israel Jewish group. So you see how ludicrous the whole thing is. There are good Jews and bad Jews. We're not allowed to associate with Max Blumenthal. He's Jewish. Why? Because his line on the Middle East is the wrong line. So I think that shows us really what this is really all about. Anti-Semitism is terrible. We all oppose racism if we're on the left. I was actually physically attacked, John, in a bar in Hungary, in Budapest, in the mid-90s by a neo-Nazi. He thought I was Jewish and he beat me up. It was very frightening. German tourists came to my aid. So I know that anti-Semitism exists. I know there are people who would attack Jewish people physically and who have this ideology. But I think it's very wrong to use this falsely, to make false accusations against people, Jewish or non-Jewish.
To weaponize it.
To weaponize it for geopolitical reasons, because they have the wrong line on foreign policy. This is what this is about. Ken Livingstone hasn't got a racist bone in his body, yet he's being vilified, not because of the clumsy things he said about our agreement and Hitler in the past, but because he's got the wrong kind of foreign policy. Ken Livingstone supports the Palestinian cause. He's against wars of intervention. He strongly opposed the Iraq war, like George Galloway. And that's the crime of Ken Livingstone.
And he's a strong ally of Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah, and it's about trying to enforce, trying to get dissent, trying to stamp down dissent on foreign policy, particularly those who oppose neoconservative foreign policy in the Middle East. And that's what this is about.
Now, Neil, Wikipedia, I believe there's been some jiggery-pokery going on with this objective and invaluable reference tool that everyone goes to when they're looking for information quickly. But it seems that it's not so objective as many people thought.
Well, jiggery-pokery, I mean, that's putting it very mildly. We've got the case of one editor who has made over 133,000 edits, editing almost every day, around the clock, 24/7, since 2004. This man has edited, for example, George Galloway's page thousands and thousands and thousands of times. All the time he targets anti-war voices, anti-war activists, those opposed to a neoconservative foreign policy, a wide range of figures, myself included. He targeted my page, edited it on Christmas Day. In fact, he regularly edits on Christmas Day, doesn't take a day off. George Galloway, Craig Murray, the former British ambassador to Uzbekistan, has been targeted, and a host of other figures. At the same time, he protects the pages of pro-war columnists and writers to make sure nothing negative goes on their page, and that the most negative possible Wikipedia page is put together for anti-war voices. John Pilger, another one who's been regularly targeted by this editor, Philip, who goes under the name Philip Cross. So this is a major operation here. And I think it shows us quite clearly just how, if you like, just...
And you think this could be organised? This could be, you know, more than the sum of its parts?
Yes. I think it would be extremely far-fetched to think that there wasn't... I think it's very unlikely that there wouldn't be at some part, some level of this, some involvement by some state or big corporate agency because of the relentless nature of the operation. It really is.
Tell me about Oliver Cam, Neil. Who is he? What is he?
Well, he is a former hedge fund trader, hedge fund manager in the city. banker. He worked in banking for many years, and he ran a blog while he was a hedge fund manager, which basically was a blog attacking, critiquing anti-war voices, anti-war figures, and supporting wars of intervention in the Middle East, making the case for them and attacking dissident voices. I reviewed his book for the Telegraph in late 2005, and after that, he began a campaign against me, a relentless campaign of attacks online, in articles on his website, regularly, even going after my wife when she ventured into print occasionally. It was a relentless campaign. And then, to cut a very long story short, because the campaign that he launched, he openly boasted of his efforts in trying to destroy my career in the mainstream. He said that he destroyed it by putting in a lot of smears, a lot of false accusations. That, for example, the one which really upset me, all upset me, but the one he falsely claimed that I denied the Srebrenica genocide, for example, which I don't and I haven't. So that happened, and I eventually, what put me off, what prevented me from taking legal action was the cost, because the cost of suing people in Britain is very, very high. I decided to crowdfund, and I've been crowdfunding that. People can send donations to my crowdfund via my website, neilclark66blogspot.com or co.uk.
And how many contributors have you had to your crowdfund?
Over 600, John, over 600. The response has been tremendous. Absolutely. 600. Thank you to everybody. Wow. Yeah, over 600 individual donations, and we've reached over £27,000 now. So I think it's so important, I think, that
actually... Well, let me make this point before we run out of time, Neil. Your campaign is not just about you. It's not just about your career, although that is key to you, of course. It is about all of us. It is about everyone who values dissent as the essence of democracy, who values the right to resist regime change, who values justice for the Iraqi people, who are no longer able to raise their voices because they're dead as a result of the war, which Oliver Cam supported and still supported in the midst of a sectarian bloodbath in 2006. It is a campaign that is being fought in the interest of everyone interested in justice, a multipolar world, and an end to the oppression of the Palestinian people. So therefore, your campaign, I think, is indispensable as part of our resistance to what we've been discussing today when it comes to dissent. You've been listening to Neil Clark. I'm John White. Until next time, remember, the only facts worth taking seriously are hard facts.